welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And, you know, I can't make any of this stuff up. I can't, you know, create all of the news that's coming forth. More importantly, I have no control over the news that you're not getting. But I will tell you this, that if we actually focus on what we need to be doing and stop worrying about the distractions in our lives and what this news cycle, this pornographic news cycle is doing, is it's completely distracting us because so many people are getting caught up in the news du jour. So please, you know, we're going through this content for a very specific reason so that everyone can completely and profoundly understand what the Constitution really means, what it really says, and how it was defined so that we can actually start using this document as our weapon and as our shield against the evil onslaught that we're facing. And so without any further ado, because it's about getting through this content, and we've got Paul with us. And actually, Paul, as I was kind of doing a summary of what we have to do, or I should say what we have to cover, there's kind of a lot here. And so we've probably got another couple weeks, possibly. But if we focus on trying to cover content, then it goes at the expense of understanding the content we covered. So I believe that understanding the content is probably more important than just covering it. Don't you agree?
Hey, GR, I think it's really important to cover it, to understand it.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons that I enjoy talking about this, because oftentimes I have questions and you're kind enough to let me interrupt the narrative so that we can get some questions answered. Because if I have questions, then I know your audience has questions.
That's right. And actually, you know, I have a unique audience because I can tell you that, you know, when I look at our streaming levels and understanding that we are broadcast in some areas, I'm going, you know, usually I'm always in the top 20 and we always start off in the top 10, in the top 10 of streamers during this time zone or during this time frame, you know, of this 24-hour clock when I'm competing with, because when we start coming on, at the 3 o'clock West Coast time, I mean, that's when Mark Levin and a lot of different other shows come on that we're competing with. And so being in the top 10, that's pretty significant. In other words, we have a lot of people listening, and I'm just shocked at the little bit of feedback that I get compared to the amount of people that listen. And I think that's really because people are still not really learning, or they don't understand. And they're the adage of not asking a stupid question, and, you know, and they think that the, you know, that's, you know, the rule of the day. And actually the adage to that is the only stupid question is the one that's not asked.
Well, I think they're learning, GR. Your format's a little different, and that's understandable, because what works for you at this time is you've got a call-in line and people can call in and ask questions.
Uh-huh.
But I think sometimes people want to call in and hear their question answered on the radio. We're not set up that way,
right,
you know, at this time.
Right.
And so that may have something to do with it, that, you know, there is – and not at all to say anything disparaging about your audience, that, you know, they're looking for instant gratification. It's just that sometimes people have a question, say, I wonder if I can get this question answered now. So I would encourage people who listen to the program to call your call in line if you want to give it to them, because you will answer their question.
Yeah.
And you might, you know, you probably will even feature it on Fridays.
Right.
So if I can put in a plug for that, that's what I would do. That's one reason maybe we don't hear right away.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, I do feature it on Friday, especially if it's a real question or it doesn't go down this path of where we have a dialogue. But 9 times out of 10, I mean, yeah, just recently I've made a strong acquaintance with a great patriot out of San Francisco, Cynthia. And, you know, she calls on a regular basis and leaves me messages and feedback. And so, you know, I always take the time on Friday if I can't call her, because right now I'm just really, really busy. And folks, my winter time, believe it or not, my winter time, I have more time available to actually make phone calls, introduce, grow, and so forth. Because in the summertime, it's the only time we have, and not having kids at home or anything else, I have to supervise people coming by to do work for us. You get things done, got things to get repaired. And because in the wintertime, when you've got feet of snow, I mean, 2, 3, 4 feet of snow around your house, and, you know, getting people in and out of the house is just really hard. And accessing things, anything outside the house, is impossible. So, you know, we kind of have to hunker down every wintertime. And during that hunker down, what do? Well, I don't have to worry about those outside things. So it really, you know, I love winter. I mean, most people love the summertime because wintertime is where I actually get a break and can, you know, help nurture relationships and doing those types of things. So I hope everybody kind of understands. And this is not just, you know, just me. Anybody, like everybody I know that I work with in Wyoming, the Dakotas, in places that have hard winters, it's like that. I mean, that's just the normal, you know, summertime is where they, you know, they really go, you know, hot and heavy all day, all night. They just work until the sun goes down, which is very late at night. And, you know, then they just fall, you know, pass out to sleep, and then they wake up and drag themselves through the routine of the day just to get to sleep really late again. Anyway, it's a hard routine. It's a hard life, but, you know, I love where we live other than the government. And let me just kind of leave it at that. I appreciate your insights, though. I do know it is difficult. Most people probably do want to have a call in when they know they can just call in because they're in the car. And when they get home, they forget. And, you know, folks, what I do when I'm driving and I listen, and as a matter of fact, you know, I usually share on Feedback Friday some of the stupidity I have to suffer through when I listen to the conservative entertainers. Like, you know, last Friday I complained about Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly, you know, and how they converse back and forth as elitists and idiots. But anyway, you know, and they're nice guys. I think they're trying to do, you know, some good, but they don't understand the harm that they're really doing. My point is that, you know, as I kind of go through my feedback or as I kind of go through these points, you know, I try to give, you know, as much as I can, but I do know it is very rewarding to have that direct conversation. So folks, if you call me, there is a high likelihood, and anybody that has ever called me to say, hey, I've got a question, I will engage you. The day I can't engage you, and you know, I'll start telling you on the, you know, over the air here, you know, that I am just too busy to engage, you know, customers, or I should say listeners and people that are looking for help. I mean, you send a, you know, you put up a lifeline, we're going to try to do everything we can to help you. And it's not uncommon that, you know, people actually do reach out at the first, and the next thing you know, they go, wow, I mean, this was more than I imagined. So anyway, anywho, we left off in the middle of, I believe, let me see here. We left off in the middle of James Madison talking about jurisdiction. And so we, you know, kind of ran out of time, but at least we plowed forward. And so I could say, let's start off with the top, but let's kind of go, you know, into where we left off, but I'll lead off with this because he talks about virtue and intelligence, folks, and this how essential it is for we the people to be both virtuous and intelligent. He says, if there be sufficient virtue and intelligence in the community, it will be exercised in the selection of these men. Now, when we put our virtue in our ideologies, that's great for our preachers to do good things. But when we put our virtue in our government, in our public servants, you may want that public servant to have the same religion as you because you think that might help you. But actually, the only thing that helps you is that these men have the intelligence and the virtue in understanding and following the Constitution. You know, how many people have not heard how there are people espousing Christianity and some Christian doctrine that if Christ was here today, he'd be a socialist because he'd be taking care of everybody through welfare? And we understand that is a perversion. It's an absolute perversion. So why would we want to continually cling to, you know, well, our guy is better at this, when the only way to fix the paradigm is making sure that your guy that you select is committed, hard committed, undaunted in supporting the Constitution and demanding full compliance of themselves and all who serve the people, that they will comply to the Constitution. So I just wanted to make this real point because that's kind of what we just left off with. That Madison was kind of talking about this virtue and intelligence. It's not a social, spiritual virtue. It is a virtue in the law. Does that make sense?
Great.
Okay. All right. All right. So, and I know there's people out there that, you know, that think, oh, you know, because their bias really leans so hard towards their religion. And I try to help people understand that this Constitution is designed to allow, you know, all different religions to thrive, or I should say all different doctrines to thrive in this, I'll call it a petri dish of establishing truth, because it's only when, folks, what does it take for somebody to really understand and learn, you know, how, you know, some of their concepts may not be the truth? It's by challenging them, right? Is that not right, Paul? Challenging
parents.
Right. And so it's important that we open ourselves to challenging our paradigms instead of clinging to, because that actually feeds to, you know, the, you know, when Enlightenment was moving forward, and these were good, virtuous, religious people that were moving forward, they actually talked to those people who couldn't challenge their paradigms as those who were stuck or steeped in their superstitions.
We need to be willing to challenge your paradigm.
Right. Absolutely.
To look for truth and determine that, you know, if what I've considered for so long doesn't work, maybe there's a better option. And if there's a better option, then obviously it's better for me and for you, and it will have benefit. And so we should be willing to consider things. And that's hard. Sure, it's hard to do.
Oh,
it's
sure.
Been hard for me.
Yep.
I mean, you, the paradigm shifts that I've been going through since coming to, reclaiming the Republic is like whiplash. It's just not easy to do.
Yeah, I understand that. And it may be a culture shock. It is a paradigm shift. I don't like using that because most people, when you say this is a paradigm shift, what does that say? That insinuates that, well, you're looking at things wrong. And so the way I like to actually say it so that people don't feel offended is it's a broadening of your paradigm, because you're looking in the right direction, but we just need to broaden it so you see the bigger picture.
I like that.
There you go.
I may start using that.
Right. But technically, in critical thinking, they'll tell you that those are paradigm shifts. But actually, you know, it's a real paradigm shift if you're looking in the wrong direction and you're teaching somebody. And I've actually had people like that. As a matter of fact, one of the strongest patriots that we have in our group is a admitted hardcore Democrat that voted for Obama and so forth. Mm. And, you know, folks, this only proves that there's so many people out there. I mean, there are people that we talk to, and there's probably people that listen to the show on a regular basis that really have sold, you know, or have given up on even Republicans of being able to find the truth. But if we actually have the ability to, you know, bring all different people to the truth, and because if you really want liberty, because there's Democrats out there that want liberty, they want their freedoms, and they're starting to recognize this is why the walkaway movement has kind of helped a lot of Democrats. And the problem is that they're not finding the real solution that they're looking for. They're just walking away from a bad, you know, something that they've recognized that is bad, but they still haven't found the solution.
Right.
Right. Anyway, and we could talk after maybe all of this, maybe we can talk about some of the the fallout of all of these things happening from Trump, from the Democratic Party and all of this, how the Constitution Party has, you know, had the opportunity to really seize the day and grow. And anyway, but that's a topic for another day. So go ahead and let's take off with Madison continuing on this jurisdiction.
All right. So this is June 20th, 1788. And Mr. Madison, following where we left off, right?
Right.
Having taken this general view of the subject, I will now advert to what has fallen from the honorable gentleman who presides. His criticism is that the judiciary has not been guarded from an increase of the salary of the judges. I wished myself to insert a restraint on the augmentation as well as diminution of their compensation and supported it in the Constitution, but I was overruled.
Actually, in the convention.
Right.
Supported it in the convention, not in the Constitution. I mean, kind of the same thing.
I'm sorry.
Sorry. It's okay. It's just important to differentiate that. Okay.
Right. But I was overruled. I must state the reasons which were urged. They had great weight. The business must increase. If there was no power to increase their pay according to the increase of business during the life of the judges, it might happen that there would be such an accumulation of business as would reduce the pay to a most trivial consideration. This reason does not hold as to the president, for in the short period in which he presides, this cannot happen. His salary ought not, therefore, to be increased. It was objected yesterday that there was no provision for a jury from the vicinage. If it could have been done with safety, it would not have been opposed. It might so happen that a trial would be impracticable in the country. Suppose a rebellion in a whole district, would it not be impossible to get a jury? The trial by jury is held as sacred in England as in America. There are deviations from it in England, yet greater deviations have happened here since we established our independence than have taken place there for a long time, though it be left to the legislative discretion. It is a misfortune in any case that this trial should be departed from, yet in some cases it is necessary.
So
it must be there. Go ahead.
You know, I got to interject. You know, last night I was thinking about this because we conversed about this last week in the national meeting regarding the legislation's discretion and control. And clearly, because this kind of came up last week, when it came to common law, how only the legislature has the authority to dictate what that law will be.
Right.
And here it says right here that when it comes down to, you know, deviations of the jury and everything else, who has the control over that? Does the court have any control over it? No. It's left right here. It says, though it be left to the legislative discretion. Folks, your judges and the Bar Association has seized control and usurped legislative authority. And this proves how the boundaries or the separations of power are not being respected. And I just needed to really kind of point this out. So I usually don't want to do this, but since it kind of goes with this theme, and it really helps people, especially now as we've seen some of the court decisions and so forth, because it's that time of year that the court actually, you know, I'll just say disappoints because they make their hallmark cases. And anyway, so let's go ahead.
You and I just had a discussion about that recently, didn't we?
Yes,
about,
yes.
What the court did.
Yeah, last week. Yeah, it was last week.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Right. Okay. Let's see. I think I left off it. It is a misfortune that any case, is that where I left off?
Yep.
It is a misfortune in any case that this trial should be departed from, yet in some cases it is necessary. It must be therefore left to the discretion of the legislature to modify it according to circumstances. This is a complete and satisfactory answer. It was objected that this jurisdiction would extend to all cases and annihilate the state courts. At this moment of time, it might happen that there are many disputes between citizens of different states, but in the ordinary state of things, I believe that any gentleman will think that the far greater number of causes, 99 out of 100, will remain with the state judiciaries. All controversies directly between citizen and citizen will still remain with the local courts. The number of cases within the jurisdiction of these courts is very small when compared to those in which the local tribunals will have cognizance. No accurate calculation can be made, but I think that any gentleman who will contemplate the subject at all must be struck with this truth.
Okay, so...
yeah, okay.
Okay, so... yeah, and you were going to just mention that Madison that continued on, but he spoke so low that they couldn't hear what he said, so they didn't document it. So those things were lost, and then... boom, you know, they caught the rest of it. And so what he's talking about here, this very last paragraph, it was objected that that this jurisdiction would extend to all cases and annihilate the state courts. At this moment of time, it might happen. He's saying it might happen that there may be many disputes between citizens of different states. Remember, we talked about this last week. In Article 3 of the Constitution, and it's Section 2, regarding the jurisdiction, where the federal court has jurisdiction over all things arising under this Constitution, and then they stipulate these specific types of cases, where so the federal court has jurisdiction over any case between a citizen of one state with a citizen or of another state. You know, a citizen of another state or another state. So, in other words, if a citizen is being harmed by a state, another state, or a person or entity in another state, then the federal court would have jurisdiction. And so what he's saying here is it might happen that there are many disputes between this, you know, and the different states. But in the ordinary state of things, I believe that any gentleman will think that the far greater number of causes, 99 out of 100, will remain within the state judiciaries. So guess what? Madison was wrong. Because the 11th Amendment was, you know, it only came out in, I think it was ratified in what, 1795?
1795, I think.
Yeah. And so, in other words, the states demanded that amendment in 17, you know, it's in my constitutional. I will be right back, Paul. We've got a hard break, believe it or not. And I will come back, folks, with when that amendment was proposed. And then, you know, when it was ratified. So you'll actually see how long it took for the states to say enough. You're getting into our knickers, and our sovereignty is far more important than you maintaining this jurisdiction. We'll be right back after this.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google Donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, health care, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved and supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so I'm sorry about that, Paul. I don't have iguana eyes where I can watch the clock and these other things. So anyway, I found it, and it was proposed in 1794 and ratified in 1798. And so, you know, this is kind of interesting because this is where the states actually stood up and said, hey, you know, federal court, federal government, you cannot have jurisdiction in these cases that are arising between citizens, you know, of one state that have a problem or an issue matter with either another state or a person or entity within that other state. We will maintain sovereignty to where the harm has occurred, because they already recognized that they weren't getting the justice that they felt that they needed, and they couldn't have the fair trials that, you know, there was enough uprising. I mean, so Madison really, he didn't see this coming. He didn't. Well, not just him. You know, those in the Constitutional Convention really didn't see this coming, because this was obviously a defect in the Constitution. And so much so that as I look at 1798, the ratification of this, this was a real snapback. Because, folks, if the federal government could claim jurisdiction in all these types of cases, it would aggrandize the types of issues that they could get involved in. Does that make sense?
Well, sure. But this is apparently a big surprise.
Right.
I mean, people were probably just really going, you know, using this quite a bit more than certainly Madison expected.
Correct. And so, you know, they started realizing that the federal court was getting involved in things that they just shouldn't have been involved in. So when they submitted this, you can tell it took a little while. And I'm going to tell you that when you take power back from an entity that actually is, you know, now standing with this power and they're wielding this power, when you take it back, it's kind of like when we broke away from England. At what point did England say, I'm okay with them being gone? Never.
Oh.
Never. As a matter of fact, which is why they got into our knickers in the Civil War, which is why, you know, after the Civil War, when the 14th Amendment passed and all of the states came back into the Union, and England was going to basically not get any war debts at all, you know, the loans that they made with these other states because of that. See, you know, there's sovereign citizen movements that actually lie, that say that the United States was always paying, but that didn't happen until the Organic Act. The Organic Act is where we actually started paying, you know, these unconstitutional or these illegal debts. And so anyway, long story short, no entity that has to surrender power does that willingly or forgets about it. They always remember, they took this, we want that back. And so, believe it or not, the courts have tried to use the 14th Amendment to take these powers back. And technically, they can't. And in those cases, because like the claim of civil rights and those types of things, that they do apply to. No, the civil rights issues mean that governments can't pass laws or do these types of things. These things should be quickly and easily swatted down at the local level and to be done first. Now, it's one thing if the local state does not do the right thing and say, we have a right to, you know, we don't have, you know, we don't have to follow this. No state shall enforce, make or enforce any law that violates these privileges under the Constitution, privileges and immunities. You know, we'll do what we want to do. So if they, you know, continue doing that, then the appeal with the federal court system can easily step in and say, no, the 14th Amendment keeps you from being able to do these things. And so anyway, when we look at this, I think this is kind of big because, you know, Madison said that it wasn't really going to happen, but he was really trying to define, you know, why this was important, that he thought that 99 out of 100, that if this would be, you know, justice could be served. And obviously it wasn't, and it didn't. So the state stepped in and did what they needed to do to fix the deficit or the defect in the Constitution. So now we get back to common law. And Patrick Henry, you know, I usually don't have lots of anti-federalist comments, but I think it's important where we kind of talk about what he's talking about, you know, because when they – well, let's read this and then we'll do the analysis or we'll talk about it.
Okay. The appellate jurisdiction as to law and fact, right?
Yep, that's it right there. Yep.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Henry. The appellate jurisdiction as to law and fact, notwithstanding the ingenuity of gentlemen, still, to me, carries those terrors which my honorable friend described. This does not include law in the common acceptation of it, but goes to equity and admiralty, leaving what we commonly understand by common law out altogether. We are told of technical terms and that we must put a liberal construction on it. We must judge by the common understanding of common men. Do the expressions fact and law relate to cases of admiralty and chancery jurisdiction only? No, sir. The least attention will convince us that they extend to common law cases. Three cases are contradistinguished from the rest. Quote, in all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers, and consuls, and those in which a state shall be a party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction. In all the other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact, end quote. Now, sir, what are we to understand by these words? What are the cases before mentioned? Cases of common law as well as of equity and admiralty.
You know what? I'm going to go ahead and read a little bit further on this because he's making a good point because, you know, when we really look at, you know, some of these cases or some of the jurisdiction of the court, you know, because he's pointing out, again, this shining problem that these men were seeing, that those who wrote the Constitution, and they still saw it, they didn't see that the court would start trying to aggrandize itself. And so... Mm-hmm. I confess, I was surprised to hear such an explanation from an understanding more penetrating and acute than mine. We are told that the cognizance of law and fact is satisfied by cases of admiralty and chancery. The words are expressed against it. Nothing can be more clear and incontestable. This will, in its operation, destroy the trial by jury. The verdict of an impartial jury will be reversed by judges unacquainted with the circumstances. But we are told that Congress are to make regulations to remedy this. I may be told that I am bold, but I think myself and I hope to be able to prove to others that Congress cannot, by any act of theirs, alter this jurisdiction as established. So what he's really doing is he's making this prediction, he's prophesying that because of this jurisdiction, the trial by jury will be wiped out, and the concept of, you know, not jury nullification, but the concept of the admiralty, or I should say magistrate nullification, right? Because that's what it is, where a judge will review a case and he will nullify the jury. Actually, and it was said earlier, if you remember last week, where it was previously stated that the process would be that the judge would basically set aside the judgment and send it back to the lower court for review. And so let me ask you this. Was Henry right? Did the trial by jury get destroyed, or did the appellate court actually do what I think it was Madison that stated it? It may have been Randolph, or it doesn't really matter. But I clearly remember it was said that the judgment would be set aside and sent back to be, you know, basically reviewed and or fixed by the lower court, that they wouldn't actually make those decisions. Is that not correct? You don't remember? It's okay if you don't remember.
I don't remember. Yeah, help me. Yeah, I actually need help understanding the question, and I've got a follow-up question.
Oh, it may have been Pendleton. I think it may have been Pendleton that said this, because Pendleton the verdicts, because this was when they were going through common law. And so, folks, if you kind of just re-review this, because I didn't know I was going to be dealing with this scenario, so I may have to, you know, take some time and you do a go back on this in our next show, or the subsequent show. But bottom line, I do clearly remember that it was basically projected in the terms and definitions by the Federalist that what the federal courts would do is to set aside the verdict when something has been done wrong. They don't review, and they can't inject new evidence. And for the most part, this is what's happened. This is how it happens. Is that the courts, even the Supreme Court, has sent back cases back to the inferior court to actually, or the federal courts have sent it back to say, no, you didn't get this right. You need to, and they give them the advisement of what they need to do. And then the court will then fix, you know, the verdict of the court, and obviously, you know, the verdict of the jury. Because there are times when juries actually do the wrong thing. We've had that happen. Okay. And so when the law is violated, you know, it's not necessarily a jury nullification as much as it is a magistrate nullification when injustice is being served. Because the principle is that and 9 times out of 10, folks, you know, like when the jury gets it wrong, it's only when they get it wrong that they've actually accused the person wrongly, or they've given a guilty verdict when it probably shouldn't have happened. It never happens, because nobody makes an appeal when they murder somebody and they get off, you know, because the jury right. wants social justice and they let them go. That never gets appealed. So it's not in that particular case. It's only in the cases where somebody has been wrongfully convicted, where the superior court actually looks at it and goes, you know what, there's a problem here. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that's my whole point. Here's a case where Henry was kind of pointing out, and it was glaring because he made the same point regarding the cases between states and, you know, other persons of other states and so forth. And so I can clearly see that a lot of people saw this problem, you know, that the 11th Amendment really needed to come forth. But what Henry was saying, this, he was basically making this comment that this would wipe out trial by jury. And he was wrong, because in essence, what he's saying is the wiping out of trial by jury would actually violate the Constitution. It has been my supposition. It has been, you know, my fixed paradigm that I've been telling everyone, that when you look at the anti-federalist arguments, the arguments that they're making is stating that the Constitution is the defect when it is not the defect. What they're talking about is when the Constitution is being violated, then it's the defect. In this particular case, there was both a defect and a violation, because the Constitution was clear that the trial by jury was preserved. And and actually the Bill of Rights came back and even further fortified that. But nevertheless, and, you know, so they, one of the things Henry wanted was he wanted a Bill of Rights, and they got them, but that still didn't make him happy. I mean, they still tried to subvert, and they successfully subverted the federal government into a large government. And I'll give you some extra analysis, you know, unsolicited, but I'll give you extra analysis. If you look at the 11th Amendment and it coming back in 1798, you know how I was saying that nobody likes losing power?
Sure.
So what happened in 1798 were the Alien and Sedition Acts, where the federal government then, you know, okay, we just lost some power. The courts just lost this ability to, you know, pull up and get involved in cases that, you know, helped us aggrandize, you know, our jurisdiction. And now they just passed a law that basically said, you know, we're going to silence you and we're going to arrest you and, you know, violate the actual Constitution and the amendment, the Bill of Rights, by saying you don't have a right to free speech. And so, you know, was this a contradiction or was this a reaction? The Alien Sedition Acts, was it a reaction? Because I think the people in power started recognizing that there was a rift occurring in the sentiments of the people. And I think the Alien Sedition Acts was one of those positions that actually was, you know, woke the people up to say, we need to move in a different direction here.
Right.
Right. I'm trying to give you, you know, as the dominoes were kind of falling from, you know, 1794 to 1798, because that actually spanned from Washington's term of office to where Adams got in. So why did it take 4 years to ratify? Well, because it wasn't, you know, I think Adams' presidency helped, you know, galvanize the need for ratifying this amendment. Because Adams was, he was kind of...
he went off the reservation.
He was a puffy man. I mean, you know, he was rough around the edges, you know, and he was, you know, very arrogant.
Okay.
Anyway.
Hey, quick question.
Yes.
I had a follow-up.
Okay.
And there's been more than a few mentions of chancery and admiralty, and they knew what they were talking about when they used that, but they don't explain it. And I'm wondering if you would clarify what's going on here when they refer to common law and then chancery law and then admiralty law, because chancery makes me think of England.
Well,
chancery makes me think of the law of the sea.
Well, so chancery law is a law that is regarding two nations or agreements between two nations. So like today we have a carte blanche diplomatic immunity for all chanceries, or I should say, all those who are in a chancery position, the ambassador and very specific people that they dub, you know, and bottom line is those people are spies. And they're given this, because it's been done a long time and everybody does this, that we assert diplomatic immunity. Now, there have been countries, like during the Cold War, Russia would actually go after people that had diplomatic immunity and, you know, either plant evidence or they'd find legitimate evidence and they would go, you know, and they'd incarcerate people. And that became real problems because they said, you know, you may have diplomatic immunity, but they challenged this idea that, you know, you're not just going to have carte blanche access to be able to spy on us. And so, because, you know, we have a right to protect ourselves, and that was always an issue, but that's chancery law. Admiralty law is, as I understand it, it is the economic side of the international laws.
Okay.
And then you have maritime law, which, you know, deals with, obviously, you know,
the law of the seas.
Laws of the seas and those types of things, right? Yeah, so anyway. Yeah, okay. And I'm surprised they mentioned Admiralty and Chancellery. I'm surprised they didn't mention maritime, because maritime's also listed. It's also mentioned, but anyway. Apparently everybody felt, oh, well, that's not a problem, maritime law.
Okay. So, you know what? There is something else. I noticed another highlighted part just below this that I would have missed if I hadn't scrolled down, that Mr. Henry says. Do you see that?
Yes, go ahead. Yes.
344.
Yes, on the same page, yes. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, so go ahead.
Cover that. Okay. They may be tried by the most partial powers by their
most,
I guess that's most implacable enemies, and be sentenced and put to death with all the forms of a fair trial. I would rather be left to the judges. An abandoned juror would dread the loss of character like a judge. From these and 1,000 other considerations, I would rather the trial by jury were struck out altogether. There is no right of challenging partial jurors. There's no common law of America, as has been said, nor constitution, but that on your table. If there be neither common law nor constitution, there can be no right to challenge partial jurors. What the right is as valuable, yet the right is as valuable as a trial by jury itself. Okay, GR, where is he going with this?
Well, so in the Constitution, because he's making a point that they've had this right to challenge juries or jurors, because when the jury is selected, they don't. And so do they today go through a jury selection where they can challenge and say, okay, I, you know, this person's biased because they're, you know, very favorable to law enforcement, and we don't believe we'll get a good verdict from this person. So both sides have the ability to challenge jurors.
Okay.
So he's talking about that, because that's not in the Constitution. But somehow it's being done, and it is done at the federal and state level. And so...
So are you saying that the challenging of jurors is unconstitutional?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, remember, Henry made the point, and the Constitution makes the point, that Congress can make such rules and regulations in defining the procedures and the processes of the court and so forth. I mean, we've even seen that the state legislatures possess that. So, you know, as they moved along, they created that as a part of our common law. In other words, those things that became common practices, that just became the common law procedures. So, but he was just pointing out that here again, he was saying that I would rather have the trial by jury struck altogether if we can't actually, you know, challenge, you know, the partiality of a juror. And, you know, here he is. I've told you that, and, you know, I try to provide a little bit of evidence that Patrick Henry at this point in time, I don't think his best interest was what was good for America. I think he was being a drama queen in trying to protect the Virginia cabal.
Mm. Okay.
Sorry, you know, I know he's a good man, but I think that he was on the wrong side at this point.
Okay.
Because the powers that the states had basically made or assumed and was able to, you know, hold on to under the Articles of Confederation from the Revolutionary War forward to this point were pretty nice powers. And having to surrender that to this general government, they just saw as a huge threat. Anyway.
Right. So it looks like we're going on to John Marshall, and it looks a little long. How are we doing?
Okay, so we've got enough time to finish this show if you do the very first paragraph. So go ahead and hit this one paragraph.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, this part of the plan before us is a great improvement on that system from which we are now departing. Here are tribunals appointed for the decision of controversies which were before either not at all or improperly provided for. That many benefits will result from this to the members of the collective society, everyone confesses, unless its organization be defective and so constructed as to injure instead of accommodating the convenience of the people. It merits our approbation. After such a candid and fair discussion by those gentlemen who support it, after the very able manner in which they have investigated and examined it, I conceived it would be no longer considered as so very defective, and that those who opposed it would be convinced of the impropriety of some of their objections. But I perceive they still continue the same opposition. Gentlemen have gone on an idea that the federal courts will not determine the causes which may come before them with the same fairness and impartiality with which other courts decide. What are the reasons of this supposition? Do they draw them from the manner in which the judges are chosen or the tenure of their office? What is it that makes us trust our judges? Their independence in office and manner of appointment. Are not the judges of the federal court chosen with as much wisdom as the judges of the state governments? Are they not equally, if not more, independent? If so, shall we not conclude that they will decide with equal impartiality and candor? If there be as much wisdom and knowledge in the United States as in a particular state, shall we conclude that the wisdom and knowledge will not be equally exercised in the selection of judges?
Yeah, so, and here it's interesting, you start really seeing a very unique way of Marshall's vernacular. He speaks in questions, you know, and most people don't do that. As a matter of fact, in some respects, that's kind of a cultural thing. But I don't want to dive into that because I don't want to be accused of, you know, anti-cultural. But it's interesting because when he speaks, he actually asks lots of rhetorical questions. And he'll go to question, and then are we to assume? And so he'll eventually get to it. And we're going to actually find in this dissertation, I believe it's in this dissertation, where he actually talks about jurisdiction. We may have already passed that, where he asks these questions, and then he basically says, hey, look, the court, if somebody makes a law, or if there's a law in front of the court that is not within the jurisdiction of the federal government, they will basically say the law is void and, you know, violates the Constitution. And I'm going, you know, here's a guy that was saying one thing, but he sure acted a different way when he put that black robe on, if you know what I mean. Because he absolutely did the other, instead of saying that this is void and this is unconstitutional, he actually was the key suspect of actually lying and usurping authority through his judgments and opinions. So anyway, wow. We're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow. And folks, as you can tell, it's the end of the show because there's the outgoing music. What we're really trying to show here, and I'm actually giving you some of these citations that help prove the point. Maybe some of these aren't necessarily important to definitizing the Constitution, but it does prove the point that the anti-federalists, the foundation of their argument was that the Constitution was the problem, when actually the problems they were pointing to were violations. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.